history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, the stories are out there, and we'll never have the privilege of hearing them unless we take a little initiative, unless we ask a few questions and take the time to listen to what comes back our way. We get to do that for an hour on the radio each week, of course, but the hope is always that you're going to do it too, within your own circle. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And when we move in that direction, we always end up learning a lot. We're educated, we're entertained. So often, we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. With Thanksgiving approaching, I think of all the stories we've heard about the impromptu holiday meals in wartime, in the snow, in the tropics, in captivity. We've heard quite a few of those, but let's not forget Thanksgiving 2019 will find thousands of our men and women in uniform celebrating the holiday far, far away from those they love. There are a whole lot of ways that you can support them, but a really easy one is to sign the digital Thanksgiving card the USO has set up online. The goal was to have 100,000 patriotic Americans sign that card. And knowing this audience, I'm pretty sure we can surpass that. I have a link to that USO Thanksgiving card up for you on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And I trust that when you gather with your family this Thanksgiving, you're going to take some time to express gratitude for those who defend our freedom now and all those who've done so throughout our nation's history. We have the privilege of meeting some of them here on Hometown Heroes. Next time, we're going to introduce you to another Pearl Harbor survivor. But there are two veterans on my mind today, both centenarians, both known to friends and family as Bill. I just received word that Bill Gillette passed away this week at the age of 101. We met Bill earlier this year, a few months after he had celebrated the century mark, and one sentiment he expressed captured an idea that I think reverberates throughout all the conversations we've had with veterans on this program, underscoring just how far our world has come technologically, but reminding us that we're still not that far removed from so many pivotal eras in history.
When I was born, we did not have a car. I like to say that my dad courted my mother in a horse and buggy and lived to see a man walk on the moon. Those kind of things are amazing. I was farming with horses. We plowed until in 1942. I started training, and in 2 years, I'm flying a P-51 in war.
Bill Gillette flew 59 missions in World War II with the famed 4th Fighter Group, which destroyed more enemy aircraft than any other fighter group in the war. Some of Bill's 4th Fighter Group buddies called him G.I. Gillette because he'd originally been drafted into the infantry. We're so thankful for the privilege of meeting him and sharing his story, and our thoughts and prayers go out to Bill Gillette's family. I'm praying for Bill Barrett, too, but for different reasons. Bill Barrett has lived in Pueblo, Colorado since 1957, but he didn't start volunteering for the Pueblo Weisbrod Aircraft Museum until 2010. We had the chance to meet him at that stellar museum in 2017, and I asked him why he decided to become a docent there.
Well, I was beginning to be a little bored staying at home, so I kind of looked around for something to do. I saw an ad in our local paper that they were needing help here at the museum. So I came out and talked to him, and I was hired to be a volunteer, and I've been here ever since.
And you spend most of your time in the gift shop,
I do, yes. I do not walk too well anymore, and there's a lot of walking to if you're a tour guide.
What are the big items in the gift shop that you see a lot of people snatching up?
We have a lot of toys for kids, a lot of airplanes, and a lot of our stuff goes to kids, especially if they're with Grandpa.
And you have two hangars worth of historic aircrafts here. Do you have a favorite? It's something that's on display at this museum?
Probably my favorite at the museum is the B-29 that we have here. We call it Peachy, and the reason it is called Peachy is that there was a young man from Pueblo that was a B-29 pilot. He had a sister he called Peachy. So when we got the aircraft here, we had to name it Peachy.
I guess you did, yeah. Does it look like the ones you saw in the Pacific during World War II?
Very much so.
And Pueblo has quite a history with World War II. This airstrip we're next to had some bombers flying off of it.
They trained the crews here for the B-24s, the B-29s, and the B-17s.
So the B-29 here is your favorite. Is there another one or two that you see a lot of people gravitating towards?
And different people like different planes. I like the A-26.
Yeah.
Real well. And my favorite plane during World War II was the P-38 Lightning.
Well, and you have a picture of yourself on the most famous P-38 Lightning that ever existed, and we're going to get that story from you before we're done here. But the Pueblo Weisbrod Aircraft Museum is open 7 days a week. If you're lucky, you might run into Bill. What days are you here, Bill?
I'm on Wednesday, Saturday, and Sundays.
Wednesday, Saturday, and Sunday. So plan your visit, Pueblo, Colorado, and come say hello to Bill, 97. He'll be 98 in November. Let's go back to your early days, though.
Okay.
Belleville, Kansas. What kind of place is that?
It's a small town in north central Kansas, just south of the Nebraska line. It's a farming community, not much industry there.
Did you grow up in a big family, small family?
No, I had two brothers older than I and one sister younger than I.
So what were those growing up years like for you?
You know, that's been a long time ago. And I don't remember an awful lot about my childhood.
You just don't want to tell me about the times you got in trouble? Is that what
you're saying? Well, I can't remember any of them.
Do you remember, Bill, having any ambitions, some hopes, some dreams, some, hey, when I grow up, I'm going to do this and this and this?
Not really. I just went with the flow.
Well, I guess you would have been out of high school a few years before the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor.
That's
if you're
right.
97 now.
Yeah.
So what'd you do after high school?
I worked in the drugstore for a few years, and then I got a job as a drug salesman for a wholesale drug company in St. Joseph, Missouri. I traveled in north central Kansas and a small portion of Nebraska.
So you had a career going. You were moving on with life.
Right.
And you had a special someone in your life?
My girlfriend.
Lillian,
yeah.
How'd you two meet?
We knew each other in high school. I was a couple of years older than she. Actually, she worked in a little luncheonette there in town. I used to go over there and have a sandwich or something to eat once in a while and got acquainted with her and finally started going with her.
Yeah, so you're pretty sweet on her.
I was, yes.
What do you remember about December 7th, 1941?
I was working at the drugstore that Sunday. When I got home, I didn't know anything about it at the store, but when I got home, the radio was on and was hearing about what had happened.
Was that pretty jarring?
Yes, it was.
Did you know where Pearl Harbor was?
Not exactly. I knew where Hawaii was, but I didn't know Pearl Harbor.
Had you ever even considered the prospect of war?
No.
Nothing?
No, I never did.
And now all of a sudden, the Japanese have attacked American territory.
Right.
So what'd you do about it?
The war started in December. In January, I went to Kansas City, Missouri, enlisted in the Army, signed some papers, talked to a number of people, and they sent me back home to quit my job and come back at a later date to be inducted.
Why'd you do that? Why did you want to get in the Army? You had a good job.
I just figured it had to do it.
Your country needed you.
Country needed it.
And you didn't want to wait to be drafted?
I didn't want to be drafted, yeah. I don't know how soon I would have been drafted. At that time, they had drawings for the draft. Everybody had a number, and then every once in a while they'd have a draft and draw out the different numbers.
Did you have an expectation of what you might be doing in the Army?
I had no idea. They didn't ask me what I wanted to do. I was just wound up in the Signal Corps, and I enjoyed that.
Yeah, and a lot of people these days aren't familiar with the Signal Corps. Or if they do ever hear the Signal Corps, it's maybe they see a photograph from 70 years ago, and it says U.S. Signal Corps at the bottom. So tell us about the Signal Corps.
They sent me from Kansas City to Jefferson Barracks in Missouri. I was just there for a few days, then I went to Camp Crowder, Missouri, which was an Army Signal Corps training center. The Signal Corps was the Army's way of communicating. Mm-hmm. They did it by radio, telephone, telegraph, in person, carrier pigeon. I don't think we ever used that in where I was, but they used motorcycles some and different types of ways to communicate.
But you probably also had to go through basic training too, right?
Basic training was more or less some of the Signal Corps things that you had to do. I knew how to type because I took typing in high school. I tried to learn the Morse code, but I didn't have the ear for those dots and dashes. Then I got some cryptography training when he was there at Camp Crowder.
Cryptography. So tell us what cryptography is.
Cryptography is the encoding and decoding of messages. From our signal center, every message that went out, every message that came in had to be in code. It was our job to put it into code or decode it and deliver the message to the proper authority.
Did it take you a while to get a handle for that?
Not too much. We had a machine that did a lot of it.
What was that machine called?
It was called SIGABA, S-I-G-A-B-A.
How big was it?
About the size of a teletype machine.
Today, people carry a little machine around in their hand called a smartphone that can outcompute just about anything. But, you know, spatially, how much space did that take
probably up? Probably as big as your laptop.
All right.
Yeah. Only it was complete, you know, it didn't have a frame that came up, or this that came up.
Big and thick and kind of heavy?
Yeah. It was. Oh, yeah, real heavy. Yeah.
So what could that machine do?
It encoded and decoded the machines for us.
So you could type in a message in plain English?
Right.
And it would turn it into a code?
Into a code. The way we got that code, the machine had 10 wheels on it.
Uh-huh.
And you had to set those wheels. The first five wheels we set every day at the same – the wheels had the 26 letters of the alphabet on it, each wheel. And then each morning or each at midnight, you had to set those – five wheels at a certain number, or letters.
Right.
That was given to us by a book we had that told us how to set it. And then on every message, the first 10 digits on the message that came in told us where to set the second wheel.
Okay.
And then you just typed your message and it either decoded or encoded.
So if you get one of those wheels off by one, the whole thing doesn't make any sense.
I don't know.
You never found out?
I never found out about that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So if everything has to be encoded, it means that the nature of these messages that are being transmitted must be fairly sensitive.
We had several different types of messages. We had the routine messages. We had priority messages. We had secret and top secret. But there was five different classifications of messages.
Did you feel a sense of responsibility or maybe even pressure to not mess this up?
Well, probably yes. I was the non-commissioned officer in charge of the signal center. After I made staff sergeant, they promoted me to in charge of the signal center. I didn't do a lot of coding and decoding after that. I more or less had to see that everything got done.
And were you hoping to head overseas, or would you have been just fine staying stateside?
I figured I would be sent overseas, yes.
And you went over pretty early.
Yes, I did. 6 months after I was in the service, I was sent overseas. September 1st.
September 1st, 1942.
We left the States.
Where'd you go?
Well, I tell people that I had a 29-day all-expense-paid cruise to Brisbane, Australia from San Francisco with a 3-day stopover in the Fiji Islands.
Sounds pretty luxurious, Bill.
Well, accommodations weren't like they are today on a cruise.
Had you ever been at sea before?
No, I had not.
I was going to say, young guy from Kansas, maybe a creek or a river's about as big as it gets.
I've been in a small boat.
Uh-huh.
Going fishing or something.
So you spend
a month
on a big old ship with a bunch of guys.
Yeah, right.
What was that like?
Very crowded. The food wasn't that great. Accommodations weren't that great. Down in the hole, there were about four decks of bunks that you had to sleep in. And it was hot and sticky down there. And we would sleep out on deck if the weather was decent and if you could find a spot to...
If nobody else beat you to it.
Beat you to it, yeah.
How about submarines? Was there a concern that you guys would be in danger?
I think there was because... when you're going overseas during the wartime, you zigzag.
Yeah.
And that's for submarine protection. And it takes longer going over than it does coming back when we came back because of the zigzag.
So you get to Australia.
Right.
And what's next?
Got off the ship. They took us up to a little town called Ipswich, Australia, where there was an army air base called Amberley Field. And I understand, I've talked to some people from Australia, Amberley Field is still there.
How about that?
Yeah. We spent about 3 months there, and we didn't do a lot. They had us out in the field about a half a mile away from the main camp, and we had to walk down there to our meals and stuff. We didn't do any communication until we got to New Guinea.
You know, and I'm always struck by this aspect of you guys who lived through this time, because we have the benefit of hindsight now. We can tell you, hey, December 7th, 1941 to mid-August 1945. That was World War II for America. But when you get over there in late 1942, how long did you think this was going to last? I mean, do you have any idea how long you're going to be out there?
I had no idea.
Did you think it might be over in a year or two?
Oh, no. No, we didn't. Knew it wasn't going to be over that soon.
You're in for the long haul.
Long haul, yep.
Did you think you might be in danger?
No.
No? Even though...
Not in our conditions, no. We had a lot of air raids, and that was all. I wasn't in the combat unit, and there wasn't any fighting close by. But we did have several air raids, and we actually lost some people in our unit in air raids.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, it's dangerous. Japanese bombers can kill you.
Yeah, that's true.
And before I get further with your experience in the Pacific, what about Lillian? What'd you say to her when you said goodbye?
I don't know.
Did you think you were going to come back and see her again?
Well, you never know. At that time, I didn't know what I was going to be in.
Mm-hmm.
However, when I was in Camp Crowder, my grandmother Barrett passed away, and I didn't get a three-day pass to go home to her funeral. It took me a day to get there. So right after the funeral, I had to go back to Kansas City, and then the next morning catch a train back to Camp Crowder. She did go back to Kansas City with me. She had a sister that lived in Kansas City. So we stayed there that night, and the next morning I had to say goodbye and never saw her again until November 45.
Wow. Did you get a few letters from her during that time?
I got a lot of letters from her, an awful lot of letters. I was unable to keep them. Had no way to do that, but she kept every letter that I wrote to her.
Wow.
Yeah, and that's how I wrote this, is from those letters.
You've got some of those letters. You put personal history together a few years ago.
Right.
While we're on that topic, here you are on the other side of the world from Kansas. What did it mean to you to get those letters from your girl?
Well, it meant an awful lot to get them from my girl and my family also. My folks wrote quite often. My sister wrote quite often. I didn't hear too much from my brothers, for they were both in the service also.
Yeah, where did they end up?
One of them was in infantry in France. My other one was in Germany, and he was in intelligence some way. He never did talk too much about it.
But all three of you came home?
All three of us came home. My oldest brother was in Normandy about 3 or 4 days after they invaded it. He did get injured and got some shrapnel in his leg. They sent him back to a hospital for a few days and then right back to the front.
Well, your family certainly made its contribution. Without question. So for you, you said 3 months there at Ipswich?
Then up to Port Moresby, New Guinea.
And he would spend the next year and a half there, which we'll hear about when we come back. If you want a spoiler on where this episode's headed, check out the photos at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Let me just say that at the Pueblo Weisbrot Aircraft Museum in Pueblo, Colorado, they really love Bill Barrett. The museum also does a great job with its Facebook page, sharing veterans news items and articles from all over, and that's definitely worth a follow if you're on that Facebook platform. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.